this story is about my family, but also dioxin is like another kind of DNA that's being passed on. My father left me one legacy, but this is another kind of legacy, an environmental legacy that's in all our bodies everywhere in the world.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, introducing Carrie Arsenault, book critic, editor, and author of Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. So I guess like I want listeners to get a sense of this place that you're talking about, these places that you're talking about. So I'm wondering if you can maybe set the scene for us, kind of describe Mexico or Rumford, Maine. And
should I read something?
I would love it if you would read something. Sure. That'd be wonderful. Yeah. Great idea.
Because if I describe it, it won't be as nice. I think this might sound familiar to Montanians. Is that what you call yourselves?
Montanans.
From the porch steps of the house where I grew up, you'll see the end of the road. There, the pavement dips down to reveal the town's only traffic light, a gas station, and the roof of the family dollar store. Behind the store lies the Androscoggin River, and just beyond, the paper mill's largest smokestack emerges like a giant concrete finger. From anywhere in town, you can orient yourself to this stack, or by the ever-present ka-chink, ka-chink, ka-chink of the mill's conveyor belts, and find your way home, even from a pitch-black walk in the woods. When mill shutdowns occur for holidays or layoffs, the smokeless stacks resemble the diseased birch trees dying throughout New England. To the right of the porch, you'll see a street of clabbered homes, silent but for the occasional snarl of a jake brake on a logging truck or a motorcycle shifting gears. A mile or two out of town, the road narrows and small creeks knit through pastures shadowed by hills, a working farm or two, a long straight road, and cut hay, muddy cow paths, rotting leaves, or black ice, depending on the time of the year. The seasons, they calendared our lives. My mother stayed home while my father worked, her making pot roast, him making smokestack money. As kids, we explored the world through textbooks and made classroom dioramas of what we thought a Mayan village or a Midwestern dairy farm looked like. The rest of the world seemed to be New Hampshire or Canada. Families didn't go on overseas vacations and rarely traveled interstate. Our lives were focused inward, Red Sox games, union strikes, and grousing about the weather. Monumental philosophical ideas were surfacing across America: feminism, environmentalism. However, there were no movements in Mexico, Maine, but for people walking across the mill's footbridge to work. We were more likely to dry bras on a clothesline than burn them. We lived in a shrinky-dink world where everything was there, just smaller. We were lucky in this, felt safe with our doors unlocked at night, and ameliorated most of our sins within the latched doors of St. Teresa's confessional. At nighttime football games, we watched our fire-twirling majorettes toss their batons skyward in a spinning, blazing fan. They caught them dead center every time. Those kerosene-soaked batons in the dusk of autumn, they smelled of permanence.
I wanted to actually begin this interview where I usually like to end them. And I'm wondering if there are questions that you haven't been asked yet in all these interviews that you've done for Milltown, or topics that you've wanted to be asked about or anticipated being asked about, but just haven't come up yet.
Not many people have asked about my writing, about the writing itself. We always end up going down the environmental path or the storytelling path or family history or Acadian history, but we never actually talk about the writing. I think once or twice, maybe briefly.
So let's talk about the writing. Let's dive into it then. When I was reading your book, I found that I was really captivated by the story that you were telling, the stories, multiple stories and histories that you were telling. but I was also so drawn to your writing. It's so beautiful. It's so fluid. I don't know the French language, but I think I probably made this kind of strange connection between writing about Acadian peoples and just kind of the fluidity. And I know beauty is not a descriptor anymore, but it's really, really beautiful writing. And I was so taken by it. And so,
yeah, it's interesting that you made that connection, because there's a woman, she's become sort of a friend in Portland, Maine, and her brother both know a lot about Acadian and French Canadian history. And she told me when she read my book, she felt that my language sort of expressed the way Acadian language was expressed in some way. I can't tell you exactly what that is, or even if she told me, but there was something about the rhythm of it and the way I spoke or the way I wrote that was very rhythmic to it. And I don't know what that means, but you're onto something. We should ask her.
We should. I mean, so for your reference, I actually just moved back to Missoula, Montana from Fredericton, New Brunswick, over in Atlantic Canada. So part of the joy in encountering your book was, for me, this kind of newfound familiarity with this place in some broad, vague way, with that region's history. And can you talk a bit about the Acadian people and their history, your history, and how it pieces into the book? And then perhaps we can go back to the writing and how it fits into maybe your methodology of writing and genre.
Yeah, it's all related. So we can go in and out of it as you wish. I mean, the book started with my grandfather's obituary, which had contained some details about him I hadn't known. He was born in Prince Edward Island, and how he died, who his mother was, things like that. And so I started to just say, oh, that's interesting, I didn't know. And I sought to confirm those details. And then as I started looking into them, I come to find out they were all wrong, or something was missing from them. So I was like, huh, that's interesting. This is an obituary. And then I looked up his death record. Same information. It's all wrong. So what else could be wrong, I wondered, you know? So I followed this kind of absent or ambiguous information, which laid the groundwork for both this Acadian story and the structure of the book and all the other stories that I'm telling in this book about, you know, ambiguous information and how to find it and how to track it down. And, you know, with the Acadian story, that was one of them. So he was from Prince Edward Island, and that's as much as I knew based on that obituary. And we still had some relatives up there. My mother talked about it like it was some, I don't know, Oz, right? And, you know, come to find out, history was just so much more complicated and based on a lot of cliches that I think history has held to, or misinformation, just like my grandfather's obituary was like wrong. It was whitewashed a lot. And, you know, this is the foundation upon sort of what our family was built on. And so the more information I found, the more like lies and misinformation I found. It was really wild. And that's basically what started the book, and that's basically how the book keeps going, just like finding more and more malfeasance.
You use the word ambiguity, so let's talk about ambiguity and how it relates to genre, but also the stories. So maybe I kind of do want to talk to you more about writing, so let's talk about ambiguity and genre.
Yeah, so the book, it became about storytelling itself and how to tell stories that are ambiguous and how to tell stories that are like that story, or how to tell stories another ambiguous story is about toxic disasters that are slow kind of violences. They're not really what we think of disasters at all. They're attritional and not urgent. You know, they're just like this slow creeping fog. So thinking about that, I should also say this book probably asks more questions than it answers. So I may say a lot of questions. I may ask you questions, but I think that the ambiguity is part of it. It's part of memory too, and part of history. And I'm searching for information for my grandfather, and I find this environmental information that somebody had told me about. They were like, you can't look into your town's past and you can't look into your family's history without understanding about this environmental sort of destruction that's happening in your town. And I was like, why? That doesn't seem related. You know, everybody dies of cancer, big deal. So then those two like lines were going in parallel paths, you know, both of them being ambiguous. And then as I'm uncovering, like I said, as I'm uncovering information about both of those paths, I'm just finding it was like looking into a black hole, or I don't know, looking into Russian nesting dolls that never end. You know, you just keep going and going and going, and it just becomes more and more and more unclear. And that's related to how the relationship between toxics and disease, too. It's really, really something that's very hard to prove, as I found out. Proving that connection between environmental disaster and diseases in our town is extraordinarily hard because there are so many factors in all of these things. You know, where you live and how much you smoke and how much you weigh and what you eat and who you are. Anyway, there's so many factors into trying to prove something like that, that in and of itself, this whole exercise was an exercise in trying to find something that doesn't want to be found.
Regarding kind of this nesting doll idea of things being hard to prove and kind of the recursiveness, in reading the book, I felt you trying to move forward, trying to push forward. And I don't know that I would say you were trying to push the narrative forward, but I felt like you were trying to work through something and something would, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And I could read that in both the narrative and the way that you were writing and kind of even the tone of the book. There was this recursiveness kind of coming back again and again. And I'm wondering, did you at some point figure out a narrative structure of the book and then have to go through the research process to reach kind of this conclusion that you had? And I wouldn't even say conclusion. That's not the way I want to say it. Because there really aren't any definitive conclusions here. But was it a back and forth, finding a trajectory and then kind of doubling back on it, changing trajectory, maybe?
Yeah, well, there are no conclusions in a recursive thing, are there? So you answered that question. But my editor at Orion Magazine, who's Sumanth Brabecker, he helped me with some of the end game of this book, which was last November. And I really hadn't even figured out the exact plot by then. Mm-hmm. And so what he did was he took all the plot and put it on separate pieces of paper. And it was like 3 or 4 pages. And basically what we found was that it was me going home and leaving and going home and leaving. So that's the plot. It's just me coming and going. And that's the recursive nature. And from that, even though I had been writing about it, I hadn't really identified it as the plot, right? Or part of the structure. So what that did with each departure and return, I realized I was interrogating all the questions I was asking, like what it means to be from a place that doesn't always love you back, or what it means to consider yourself part of the working class, or what it means to stay or leave a place that has defined you. And it was a movement too between proximity and distance. And then I was an insider and an outsider. I was also a witness and a participant. And that's why I use photography too in the book to sort of enunciate that part as a witness and a participant. And I was also a critic and an advocate of the town. So that whole recursive nature that you sense was always there. I think it was just, I was able to recognize it and sort of bring it a little bit more forward in the book. And then it also, once he and I figured that was the plot, he's like, all right, we got to make 16 chapters. And your 16th chapter has to talk to chapter 1, and the 15th chapter has to speak to chapter 2. So that was another recursiveness, right, that was happening. And at the same time, we did these three in the middle of the section. In the middle of the whole book is an interlude, you know, like a center, like a target. So if you think of everything as a circle, like circling in on each other, in the middle of the book is a target. And that was when my father died, right in the middle. And it's not that the book, it doesn't center on his death, but I think the death centers the book, or death itself centers the book. You know what I mean? And that I was writing about people in my town dying from cancer, and then my father dies of cancer in the middle of me writing this book. Somebody just said the other day, nobody called me out on this, but you know, 1 out of 4 people are going to get cancer. Those are pretty high odds. So that target was there in the center of the book, and there on my father's back because he worked in that paper mill. So you did not imagine that recursiveness. It was there. And then we sort of worked to bring it out. And it also happens like internally within each chapter, or within each, even sometimes within a sentence, you know, just moving forward and going back. And that's that's kind of what it feels like. It, from beginning to end, it starts with a failure, like that of the wrong information, my grandfather's information. It ends with a failure, more wrong information. It's not typical of the genre either, of an investigative thing, because that first failure did not trigger success, you know, as most personal narratives do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with book critic, editor, and writer Carrie Arsenault, author of Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What does loyalty have to do with papermaking?
This is a story about working class people, too, of which I come from and which I maybe consider myself part of the working class, even though I don't really even have a job still, except for a writer, which is not really working class. If you think about fishermen or lobstermen, their identities are very tied into what they do. And it's the same with mill workers, but I don't think people understand that. They're really tied to being a mill worker, being a paper maker. And that identity is part of being loyal to something too, pride in that loyalty of being a paper maker and being, they produced really incredible paper in the world for publishers and magazines worldwide. And to be part of that was to be proud of that. And to be proud of it was to be loyal to it. You know, it's all very connected, and that's all connected to identity. You know, as manufacturing declined, so did perceptions about that identity and about the working class. And that also paralleled sort of the decline in their quality of their lives. But the loyalty was always there. And it also was tied to loyalty to the mill, which was good and bad, you know, loyalty to a fault, maybe. You know, if you can work for a place that perhaps may be killing you because you were so convinced that what that place supplied outweighed the cost of death, that's pretty loyal. So it's all very tied together and hard to extrapolate one from the other, you know. So when people are like, why don't they just move away? It's not a simple answer. That's like moving away from your identity. And so, and to be loyal to a place and a town. I mean, that's my pop psychology anyway.
Did you feel that same sense of loyalty to your hometown? And is this the draw that kept bringing you back despite you moving away?
Once you become familiar with people or an issue or you know people, I feel like you have a different responsibility to those people. And these are people I knew my whole life. And so when I started finding out what had been happening in our town, I felt more and more loyal to them as the book went on, even though I like hated going there a lot. You know, it was the last thing I wanted to do was drive back and forth to Maine and go to this town. It's so boring. But I became more, it became more beloved because it was something worth arguing about. I mean, the people there are really pretty wonderful people. No matter what their politic or their opinions or their whatever, they're just, they're loyal to me too. I've had so many people email me and call me and write me letters and tell me how proud they are of me for writing this book. And it's been really touching and sweet, like the whole town, the whole two towns. I mean, I'm sure there's people out there that might listen to this and say, we hate your book, but I haven't heard from them. Which I'm glad. But yeah, I'm loyal to them and they've been loyal to me. So it just, you know, it's a very dynamic relationship. And I understand that really completely in a different way in writing this book, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understood it differently too when I was a kid. We were loyal to the mill, you know. I didn't think twice about it, especially when our mill went on strike, you know.
So I want to talk a little bit more about paper and specifically paper making. For the book, you spoke with the paper mill consultant. That's just kind of towards the end of the book, I think, that you bring him in. But what can you tell listeners about the paper mill? What goes on in the paper mill? how is paper made? How is it processed, distributed, sold? And ultimately, maybe just like the crux of this book, what is causing the cancer that you spoke of at the beginning of this interview?
Yeah, so paper making uses a lot of resources, you know, a lot of chemicals and toxics. And I'm going to be pretty broad because my memory is terrible, but I would say that the sort of center of the problem, at least in our mill, or at least in the issues that I was finding, was the use of chlorine for the bleaching of pulp, which produces chlorinated organic compounds, which are dioxins and furans, through the reaction of chlorine with residual lignin. And what happens is that dioxin and furans are, up until the 90s, they used elemental chlorine to bleach the paper, which created a lot of dioxin and furans, which are maybe the most toxic things known to humankind. It was the thing that it was used in Agent Orange and lots of other terrible things. It's really dangerous in very, very, very small amounts, like small amounts you can't even measure. So it's so dangerous. So it was creating, before the 90s, before they came in with this new rule, using this elemental chlorine, and then they came in this new rule, basically, you got to use chlorine dioxide. So it created a lot less dioxin. And just like in Frenchtown, down in the Montana, same thing, the dioxin, it has a half-life of like 11 years, but if you're constantly creating it, it's not going away. And it also, it's a persistent toxic, and so it doesn't go away, and it bioaccumulates in the body. So it collects in the fatty bits. If you eat a fish that has dioxin in it, and then you breastfeed your baby, I think that EPA, this is a number I do remember because it's so shocking. The EPA says that breastfeeding infants get 77 times higher the dioxin intake that they're supposed to get because of breast milk. Dioxin is everywhere. It's in our bodies, in everybody's bodies. And so we're passing it on. This story is about my family, but it's also dioxin is like another kind of DNA that's being passed on. It's like a terrible legacy. My father left me one legacy, but this is another kind of legacy, an environmental legacy. It's in all our bodies everywhere in the world. So that's like sort of the part of papermaking that I take to task. There's lots of other terrible things too. Those would be other 500-page books. Maybe I'll write another one about how they burn tires for fuel. That's another one that's complicated, and I'm working on some things about that. You know, there's also all the waste that they, you know, dump, like down in, I was reading before I got on the phone with you in Frenchtown, you know, so all that dioxin sludge wastewater, that's all buried there. There's a 3,200-acre Superfund site near where you live. Unlined ponds of untreated wastewater, asbestos, dioxin, furans, boiler, fly ash, lime kiln, like all kinds of crazy stuff buried there. And I guess the river floods or something I was reading. And that is an interesting thing. You know, you watch these paper mills close and that's what they do. They say, oh, we're bankrupt and therefore they don't have to take care of it. And it looks like that's what happened in Montana. Our mill's still operating, but there'll be a day. Somebody will declare bankruptcy and then it's just a Superfund site and there you are. So it's like made like sausage. It's basically that. You take a log, you grind it up, you separate the lignin from the, and then you bleach it, and then you press it, and you make white paper. And it's not just the people that are actually making the paper that are affected, because all those things are going up into the sky and they're being buried in your landfills and they're going into your rivers. And yeah.
I mentioned earlier, kind of briefly, the secretary of the mill, Dot Bernard. She states pretty early on in the book that people seem to be curious about the past much more than they are curious about the future. I feel like that's pretty true, especially when thinking about the environment. Obviously, the world's current environmental situation, kind of, that feels true. How do you, as an environmental writer, if you consider yourself an environmental writer, but how do you as a writer and a conscientious person, human being, think about the future then?
It's trying to find new ways to interact with the landscape. And I'm not so naive or idealistic to say that we have to preserve everything, because we can't do that. If we were going to preserve everything, everybody else would be dead. I'm not really for killing the human race, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's what all the climate scientists are trying to figure out. I do think as a writer, though, my responsibility is to try to tell those stories so that people will want to read them. And that's no small task, because as also an environmental book critic, because I work at Orion magazine, I get so many books are either about doomsday or they're very scientific, very data-driven, or like case studies. And some of those are good, but there's not a lot of people doing this kind of storytelling that actually bring in two things that I really focused on. And I'm not saying I'm the greatest at it. I'm just saying two things that I think are really important for environmental storytelling, which are love and people. I'm looking at my bookshelf up above me and I'm like, the books that have love, I keep there in a stack. And then there's just all these other ones that come in and I'm like, where's the love in these? You know, it's very informative, but like ordinary people reading these books to arm themselves with information, they need to be equipped with stories in order to understand the world around them. And if, you know, they're getting all these things that are just like really heavy literature that are just saying, you know, the world is ending, what's that? So I just think writers need to write about people and love.
So Carrie, what are you reading now?
I'm reading My Heart. It's a novel by Semazdin Madinovic. He's a Bosnian writer. I think I said that right. It's on sale in March, and it's an incredible story of love and loss. It's a novel, but an autobiographical novel, and it's really the most heartbreaking book I have ever read in my life. And I am not sentimental or nostalgic, as you now know. Mm-hmm. The Hearing Trumpet by Leonora Carrington. There's also, I mean, there's a bunch of books I just read, like Daniel Mendelsohn's Three Rings, which I loved. I did a little blurb for that as one of my favorite books of the year for Lit Hub. I also just started reading Austerlitz by Sebald. Weirdly, never read it. And what's the book that is so famous? Elena Ferrante, that first book. Never read any of those. And I thought, because every time I go to a bookstore, I try to buy something. And I have so many books as a book critic. And I try to find books that I haven't read that are older. So those books are sitting by my nightstand, weirdly.
Yeah, the Neapolitan novels.
Yeah, the first one. I don't know. I haven't even cracked the page. I'm also reading Philip Roth, Sabbath Theater. Mm-hmm. I haven't never read Philip Roth. There's probably 20 books that I am reading for and recommending for Orion magazine, but I won't bore you with all of them.
Thank you so much for joining me today on The Right Question, Carrie.
This was really wonderful. I could just stay and talk with you all night.
The Montana Book Festival is hosting a virtual event on January 28th at 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Carrie will be in conversation with Chris Latray from Fact and Fiction Books and with Leif Fredrickson, who teaches public history and the history of the American West at the University of Montana. Look for the registration link for this event, coming soon, at montanabookfestival.com. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. I'm Lauren Korn, and this has been The Right Question.